All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report and continuing this show, the trend of talking to some of our favorite generalist investors and getting their lay of the land to recap 2025 and early 2026. We are wrapping up the show with Rick Bensignor. Rick is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, check out the In the Know Trader website. I'll post a link to that website in the show notes. That's where Rick has two products, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. We chat with Rick on a monthly basis to get his outlook on markets, metals, really any sector that is standing out to us or him. And look, Rick, as we've been chatting with you for a number of years now, I keep on thinking that you are able to call these swings in markets and play some trends better than a lot of other people we talk to. So I first want to start off with this whole concept of sentiment within this broad bull market. Yes, I know we can dive into nuanced sectors, but overall, this market, the U.S. indexes have been going simply up for the last couple of years very strongly. And you would think that sentiment would be high. There'd be a party on Wall Street. People would be excited. Doesn't seem to be that way right now. And I know you use behavioral finance in your analysis. How does sentiment that honestly seems a little depressed for how good this market has been, what's your thought on where sentiment stands in this bull market?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on for this edition, especially because we get to kind of wrap the year, talk about what's coming next. So I appreciate that. Sentiment is the type thing. So there are a variety of different polls on the street that people use as the basis of sentiment. The ones that are most popularly quoted in the media, generally I say, is the AAII poll, which are individual investors. But it's not a poll that I generally put a lot of credence into. I will give individual investors credit this year because they actually did better than the institutions did because they were buyers of the decline, the springtime sell-off of 20% in the S&P. Institutions sold and then also sold the rebound. And that's why many professional money managers are behind benchmarks this year. So this is one of the rare times that retail actually got it right. And maybe they've learned from the past that buying dips, you know, pays instead of selling the whole, which is something retail investors are more notoriously famous for. So they're wisening up over time, and that's a good thing. But in general, the AAII poll, to me, is, yes, it gauges a collection of the public's thinking, but generally, the more important people to be looking at are the professional, institutional, mutual fund and money managers and hedge fund managers. They are the ones who are actually doing the real buying and selling, not the public. And although the public obviously trades, and because trading costs have gone way down, so there's lots of trading at, you know, virtually zero commission costs, they're not the ones who are typically pushing stocks higher or lower. We'll stay away from meme names, but, you know, names at Mag 7 names, the top 50 or 100 names in the S&P, it's not the public that's generally doing the pushing. It's the big money managers who come in and buy hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, sometimes millions of shares of the stuff, buying or selling. They're the ones who you really want to get a pulse on. And there are other ways, not generally, well, the public doesn't have much ability to kind of get a sense of what they're thinking. But because, A, I talk to a number of institutions across both the mutual fund and hedge fund community, I often have a pretty good sense of what they're thinking when and if they occasionally feel like jumping out a window. And it's funny, over the years, how many times people have said to me, you know, you're not just my strategist, but you're my shrink. And thank you for helping me, you know, kind of see things clearly and not letting the, you know, their emotions get the best of them, which is what happens to many people, especially when you are responsible for other people's money. It's a tough role, and obviously they get paid handsomely for what they do, but there's a ton of pressure on that. And, you know, when you get to be a portfolio manager of other people's money, there's a ton of pressure to perform, to hopefully do better than the S&P does, you know, the broad-based market does. And having myself been in my 45-year career on the street, I was fortunate enough that I stood in the shoes of all three major roles on the market side, not the banking side of the business, but, you know, the capital markets on the trading side of the markets to be in, which was one, I was a pit trader for 12 years, trading stock index futures, COMEX gold, COMEX silver, cocoa and sugar. So understanding from the perspective of a trader and the pressures on a trader, I certainly know that avenue very well because it was my life for 12 years. Then I went sell side, went to Morgan Stanley, and within 2 years was made chief strategist, you know, chief market strategist of the firm. And understanding the pressures on a sell side strategist, as well as an even almost even more importantly, the research analysts, the pressures they have to, you know, if they go overweight a stock that's trading at 100 and they put out a 150 price target and all of a sudden that stock's trading 70, they're under pressure. And then if the stock's trading 50, they're the ones wanting to, you know, jump out a window also. And it's understanding their role and when they upgrade and downgrade that is a key part of the success I've had too, because I understand how to game their pressure and why they make certain decisions when they do. And then the third part is I was on the buy side at Morgan Stanley also for a few years, my last couple of years there. So helping run, you know, the whole prop trading book. And that gave me exposure to what it's like to have pressure of managing money. Understanding each one of those three roles and why, how, and when people in those roles often make the decisions they do, and especially the bad decisions they do, is what I think has been a huge edge over my career in being able to help time the turns the way I do, simply because along with that knowledge and understanding of why someone just downgraded a stock that's way beneath where they told people to buy it, is how you can learn how to, along with some very good technical tools that are beyond the scope of most that you find in a textbook on how to be a technician, allows me to buy and sell and help predict where markets are going to turn well before they ever got there. And you guys know, I mean, we speak every month, you know, that to come into this year, I had suggested materially reducing exposure at 609 in spiders, which was first hit early December of last year. Market went sideways for 2 months into the February high that got to 613. That's 2/3% above where it suggested to sell. And then we fell 20% into the May bottom, the April 7th bottom, which I had also called 3 weeks before we ever got there. I said, if spiders get to the low 480s, that's where you want to be a buyer. And the low of the whole move was 481.8. So, you know, we called many turns this year, most notably in the stock market, in the metals markets. Bonds really have done virtually nothing of real material movement this year and has frustrated the fixed income players the most I've seen in many years. They've been kind of twiddling their thumbs this whole year and by and large looking for lower rates and haven't really gotten them. You know, the short end the Fed controls, but they don't control the long end. And if you look at, you know, TNX at 4.15, yeah, it's lower than we were, but it's not material lower. And most fixed income managers were looking for a solid move beneath 4%. And that just didn't happen. So when you look at sentiment and you understand kind of like right now, coming into today, S&P futures were 56% bulls. That's pretty darn neutral, and we're, you know, so darn close to all-time highs. Your premise of the question is correct. Was, you know, how is it that the market is so blasé when the market's on and or near all-time highs? And I think it's a combination of some having been beaten badly this year, that it's hard for them to be enthusiastic when the market's this high off of, you know, the April bottom, and how few people actually expected that to come. Because in April, if you had said that the, you know, spiders would be in the upper 600s when it was trading at four in the low 480s, you'd be hard pressed to find too many people that would have said at the time, except for the perma bulls. And the perma bulls, I don't count, because there's virtually nothing that changes their view. And that, to me, is not generally a terribly helpful thing.
Well, Rick, you're spot on there. If you think back to April, people were saying they were leaving the United States and not coming back, and no one was going to buy the U.S. markets because they were all going to international markets. And the international markets did incredibly well this year as a theme, too. But that's after underperforming for many prior years. Just from a big picture standpoint, though, if you think about it, the last real, I guess, corrective move we had in the markets was back in 2022. And we had kind of what some would call a bear market because it was down 20%. And it was you know, a rougher year for investors. But 2023, 2024, and 2025 have all been large annual green candles. What does that setup say to you as far as from a big picture standpoint rolling into 2026 after a couple of years up? Can we sustain that again? Or is there any patterns you look for as far as a reversal year?
I'd be more inclined to think that this coming year is going to be a net up year, probably closer to the more standard annualized return of somewhere between 7 and 10%, but it'll be a rocky year. I think there'll be some moves, some decent moves along the way, that it's not just going to be a straight up year. I think you're going to have up and down, and it wouldn't surprise me if at some point also you have the chance of a real recession showing up this coming year. You know, the looking at the S&P and the fact that the top, you know, what is it, 20 names is close to 40% or 50% of the whole index. Most of us are just looking at the S&P, and the reality is it's only a few stocks. Underneath it all, I think in many places, the consumer is struggling. Car loans are, you know, defaulting at the highest rate ever. The younger generation can't afford to buy homes. It's just, you know, a lot of places are tighter than an S&P that's a percent or two from all-time highs suggests. So, yes, the economy pushes along, and those who are more well-to-do are loving a stock market and watching our P&Ls grow all the time. But the average person is struggling far more than you would ever know if you were looking at the S&P to judge the health of the economy.
All right, Rick, let's just quickly look back on 2025 then with some of your best trades. Please share with us what trades you hit well last year and maybe any misses that you had, what we could learn from those as well.
Yep. Okay. All right. So let's start, you know, stocks, as I mentioned, bearish to start the year. Got the 20% decline covered. I know we covered, so the 609 sale, we covered half at 540 and the rest in the low 480s, and then projected that the turnaround would actually ultimately get the diamonds, the DIA, so the Dow, even though we did that in spider terms. I came up with a target for the Dow at, for the diamonds at, what was it, 474. And we're trading in the 480s now. So, you know, we kind of, the outperformance of the market this year to buy and hold, where you had to face a whole 20% decline before you started, you know, turning around, making money, and then ultimately doing decently at year end, we're up significantly over what the annual return is because we sold out of a very large portion of the portfolio early in the year and then bought it back really well. So certainly in the stock market, we got very good results this year, way above what the S&P is up. What else did we do right? In June, I got clients to buy silver as a pair trade versus gold. So a hedged trade, which made you short gold but long silver. As of today, that pair trade is 50% higher than where we put it on. So you would have made 50%. You made money in silver. You lost a much less amount in gold, being short gold, in to the tune of what, again, right now is close to 50% gain. So that's probably the best or second best idea of the year. What else in the macro picture? The dollar. Early in the year, I got the dollar wrong. I got the breakout, but I try to remember a piece of it was wrong. And I remember telling people, you know, we got it wrong. Eventually, it turned bearish. And then about 2 months ago, it turned neutral. So that I do think the dollar will ultimately fall, the dollar index will ultimately fall to 95 or lower as the Fed keeps lowering rates. And when the president puts in a new Fed chair, they'll probably lower rates quickly. So I do think the dollar's probably headed still lower ultimately, but I'm in the neutral to, right now I'd say neutral to slightly bearish, but nothing more than that. I'd say those are probably the big ones of the year. I've been telling people stay away from oil all year. And that's kind of it for the big calls. The thing is, most people have the bulk of their money in stocks, and we got that very right. And you know, the metals market has, I have more exposure to metals, both bullion and gold miners, than I've ever had. And I've had them for years, but I added multiple times.
Well, Rick, just on that note with the metals, obviously we have a lot of listeners focused on gold and silver and copper and the commodities complex. It has been a wild year in gold and silver and the related equities, and one of the best years on record. Also, one of the top performing sectors this year. And we've heard from a lot of generalists that they also have the highest weighting they've ever had because they're usually spread across many sectors. As we roll out the carpet for 2026 and we say, hey, what a great year. How are you looking at the precious metals complex as we go from 2025 into 2026 in the here and now?
I'm generally still bullish the metals. It's not so easy to play them at this point. The last thing I did on the bullish side was in the November sell-off, I bought more SLV, so the silver ETF, in like at 43.5, 44. And I kicked some of it out this week at 56 and change, and that's already is proving not to be a good sale. But I still have half of that purchase, plus I've been long SLV since I think 2022, the price of 22 from years ago. I always had a thing for silver. When I was a college student, I happened to be studying in London in 1980 when silver peaked at $50 an ounce. And I remember walking into, I think it was a bank like Sharps Pixley or something, or I don't know what bank it was, but I literally bought some bars of silver and have just always stored them since then. I don't know. I just had some fascination with silver. And years ago, I bought SLV and I didn't buy it well. I bought it in 2011 after it had peaked and sold well down, but it still probably sold off 30% beneath where I had bought it. But I just had a feeling over time it makes sense to own silver. And it's finally paid off. I can't say it's been a great long-term investment because I've held it so many years to finally now, you know, make two and a half times on my money. Would have been much better other places. But it's been a hedge. And if you look at, you know, gold since the year 2000, it's performed in line with the S&P. I mean, in the last couple of decades, it's certainly been a good investment. But over the last 50 years, not necessarily. And when I think about, you know, the metals for this coming year, as long as the Fed is in cutting mode, and I think they will be, and you know, certainly that's what Trump wants, and he's going to pick whichever Kevin he picks, Warsh or Hassett, you know, you kind of get a pretty good sense that they're going to be in line with his thinking. And that's generally a good thing for the metals. It's not a one-to-one thing, but if we're going to see lower interest rates, I think you still want to be looking for pullbacks to buy metals. And if I had to take a guess now, where would I want to buy gold? It's probably, I don't know, 3850 or something like that. Now we're at 40, we're almost at 4400. I don't know if we're going to get there, but right now that's kind of the area I would think about. Otherwise, I'm just holding what I have.
Rick, I'm curious, and I want you to put back on that kind of commodities trader hat. When you were back as a commodities trader, what we've seen this year, I think especially, has been governments warming more up to commodities, especially mining and metals. And investors clearly have taken note because, yes, gold and silver have done well, but also copper, which is a large market. Copper is doing quite well outside of energy, old school oil. I feel like metals and mining are more on people's radar. What's your kind of history and your assessment of, have we seen a shift more broadly in the markets favoring metals and commodities?
I think we have. You know, I can think back to the year 2000 where you'd hear a radio advertisement of somebody, you know, hawking gold and hawking silver. But they also did it during all the bad times. They're just, you know, they're salespeople. The difference is over time is that more and more people are concerned about fiat currencies, the value of, you know, paper money, governments just printing when they need to, and the inflationary effects of that. And when the crypto space kind of came along, and let's say in the last 10 years, it's, you know, really developed, people are looking for alternative ways to have some safety for their money. And the metals have, you know, historically provided that. You haven't luckily yet needed it as an American. We're not like Argentina or places or Greece or places that, you know, have just seen currencies completely collapse. But I think there's more and more of a willingness of the general public to have what was traditionally, you know, people would say you got to have at least 3% of your portfolio in gold simply as a hedge. Well, somebody a few months ago, I forget, one of the big name guys on the street, I just can't remember which person it was, said, you know, you got to have 25% in gold. And to me, telling people that when gold is first as high as it's gotten, to first say it then, is either a guy just talking his book and trying to get others to buy higher so he can sell into it. You know, it's kind of late in the game to go tell people at $4,000 an ounce to buy gold, but there is certainly a willingness. Governments, you know, central banks across the globe are buying more and more of the gold production and what's available. And so, yeah, I do think there's been a shift in the willingness to look at alternative assets, and especially some of the hard assets. And you could put crypto into that space as something that is intended to hold value regardless of the dollar or some other, you know, foreign currency.
Yeah, Rick, I think that was actually Jeffrey Gundlach that was at Double Line Capital that said 25, 25, 25, 25. But then we also had Morgan Stanley this year come out and change their model for financial planning from the traditional 60-40 to the 60-20-20, and this plays into two themes you've discussed, that the bond market not acting like a hedge along with you know, some of the other sectors are during tough times, but not performing well really either direction, kind of being stagnant. And so that 20% allocation to what they're calling alternative assets has picked up things like, you know, gold and silver and the precious metals. It's picked up some kind of non-correlated assets, but it also has picked up the cryptoverse as another area. Bitcoin and Ethereum is the general trend. But Bitcoin and Ethereum have had a wild year too. They did hit all-time highs earlier in the year, but they've also had a pretty bad sell-off. How are you looking at the crypto side of things and that concept of having 20% in alternative assets?
I don't mind having, you know, I was a late adopter to Bitcoin. So I think I first started buying when it was, I think, 60 grand or something like that. So, you know, nothing close to where it was just even a few years ago where what I think when futures started trading in 2000, what was it, maybe 2018 or something, it was 15,000. Bitcoin was 15,000. So it went up four times before I said, okay, maybe let me go see if I can find a place to be in it. I've traded around a core position, and like many people, not thrilled to see what's happened recently. And it's a crapshoot in many ways because you really don't know how to value it. The crypto bull, well, especially Bitcoin bulls, will tell you it's going to, I've heard anywhere from 250,000 to $1 million, a coin. And if you sell, you're a fool type thing. And meanwhile, we've gone from what, $127,000 down to recently almost 80,000. That's a big decline percentage wise, in line with other declines over, crypto's, Bitcoin's historic basis. But this is not for the faint of heart. So if you buy this thing, you're buying it as a hedge, as I'm sure plenty of people buy it to try to make some money on. But you've got to have, shall I say, cojones to play, this thing, because it 30% moves against you are nothing. And you could easily have 50% moves against you. It's just part of, now you could have that happen in Tesla, or Apple, but generally people are more willing to deal with that in a true stock in a company that has earnings and valuation than something that is all the greater fool theory that, it has value simply because somebody else is paying more than you are. It's a tougher game. I have money, and I can tell you, I have bad purchases in. They were good for a bit, but now they're not. Some of the other crypto. So I have some Ethereum, I have some Solana, and I have some Ripple. Not a ton, and as a percent of my entire portfolio, the whole thing is probably 2%. But it's not insignificant. But I'm being very frank. I have losses in most of it. It's only Bitcoin that's keeping me profitable on it.
Yeah, it's a wild market, the whole crypto markets, but just interesting to hear it has been adopted fast by some of the retail investors and then more slowly by institutions, but institutions have definitely started to dip their toe in over the last couple of years. Rick, I really want to talk big picture with you about really the biggest sector in the markets, and that is AI moving into 2026. It does feel like at least now at the end of 2025, the tide has turned for these AI investments. A lot of people talking more pessimistically about them, but quite frankly, you look at the big names leading the AI charge. They're either private or they're the biggest tech names that just throw off mountains of cash with their existing business. How worried are you about AI and the whole trade around that heading into 2026?
So I've addressed this specifically with clients, and what I've said to them is the decline that we're in the midst of, and in some days it's been quite vicious, this is not the AI bubble that they need to be concerned with. It's the next one. So I think there's still another rally coming. I'm not sure if it's peaking in 26, 27, or 2028, but there will be one more significant rally that will be the one that drags every last person into those names. And then to make it equivalent with something, you think about what was like the year 2000 for the tech bubble. March of 2000 is when that whole game ended, and Nasdaq sold off, I think it was 76% over the next couple of years. So comparing historical movements in these bubble kind of conversational areas of the market, this decline was foreseeable, but I've been buying some of the names on dips. Like in November, I was fortunate, bought more stock in a 48-hour period on November 21st and the 22nd than I have ever done. So I caught the bottom on a lot of these. Got a decent rally, but a lot of them have also come back to near those November lows. And take a name like CoreWeave, which just took out the November low this week, and then today it's up, I don't know, 12%, something like that. It's flying. That although the low this week was lower than the low in November 21st, that's a double bottom and flying. So I think that bottom is in. I think we're probably close to the bottoms on what has been a nasty sell-off. Take a name, Palantir. When it had its last earnings report, I think it was trading about 208. The earnings came out. It traded up to about 220 in the aftermarket. And within a week, I think it was trading 180, or even within a day or two. I mean, you know, and fell all the way, what, maybe into the 150s. It's, you know, there have been some huge percentage moves. But this is not the popping of the AI bubble. This is the one that let out some air. The next time somebody decides to blow up this balloon is the one I'm concerned about. And I'm not concerned as the balloon is being inflated. It's not being there when it pops, because that one will be a nasty, nasty decline that will make what we just saw the last couple of months pale in comparison to what would come down the road.
Well, Rick, one other sector just to work in before we wrap is the small cap sector. They have been the quote unquote laggard trade for a while, and they finally have had a good, let's say, last month or so, and started playing catch up. And I think some of that ties into the Fed rate cutting cycle and the anticipations that if Trump puts in some of that's very dovish and that they keep cutting rates, that their cost of capital will go down. So we've seen some action across the board and a broadening out in the market. So it's not just the Mag 7. You know, you got a lot of sectors participating, but even the small caps playing along. How are you looking at that more dicey sector of the market, but more volatile sector as well?
Yep. So, you know, this week, IWM made a new all-time high. It's done this a few times where it makes nominal new all-time highs and then fades. It's also the type of thing I've talked about in the past. But the thing is, where it sold off to in the, I guess, what was it, the April low, for those of you who know cloud charts, more formally known Ichimoku Kinkuyu, in America and the Western world, we call them cloud charts. If you pull up a long-term monthly cloud chart, the low in April was the bottom of the cloud, just like the lows in 2023 were the bottom of the cloud. It came all the way back out. It's now on all-time highs. I think over time, this probably gets up to, so it's trading 251. I've got targets at like 310 to 320, and that could take, you know, a year or two or more to get there. But I think in general, they're okay. It's just a dicier, as you say, you know, more speculative part of the market. They like when interest rates go down. You've got a president who's going to help push them down. So I think they're okay, but expect volatility. And if, you know, if this thing pulled back to, I don't know, 220, I'd probably be happy to buy 220. I just don't think right now that we're probably going to see that. Even the low in, what was it? November's low was 220, roughly 229. Even that feels like a decent low because that was a spike low that ended up closing on the high of the month. So even like in candle terms, I think that low is probably going to hold for now. So in general, I think small caps will do okay, mostly because of lower rates, and they've been underappreciated for a while, so they're playing catch up also. And people are, you know, there's a point to where paying for the large cap, and especially the Mag 7 type of names, even if it's not officially a Mag 7 name, but the, you know, the Broadcoms and, well, Oracle's gotten whacked. So other than today's big advance, you know, there's some opportunity there to, I think, come in some of the beaten down Mag 7 related names, even if they're not officially a Mag 7 name. The Mag 7 themselves, they'll do okay, but I think they're largely spent. So I don't mind looking at second and third tier Mag 7 types of names. You know, let's call it the top 50 names in the S&P, but not necessarily the top 10.
I feel like this year was all about a catch-up trade, especially at the end of the year. And hey, into next year, you've given us a lot to consider here, Rick. It's been great having you on the show throughout this year. I look forward to chatting with you in 2026. And for everyone listening, I highly recommend checking out that In the Know Trader website and signing up for either that weekly report, the Tactical Trader Report, or that daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet to keep you abreast of what's going on in these markets, especially if you're an active trader. And aiming to beat these markets and also be well diversified. Rick, thank you so much for your time. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. We'll chat with you in 2026. And everyone who listened this weekend, thanks for spending some time with us this weekend. Very happy holidays and Merry Christmas to all of you. And we will be back with you in the new year.
The very same to you guys, too. Thanks for having me on. Happy and healthy to everyone.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.